On this week's Devils in the Details, consecutive league losses to Fulham and Man City leave United 11 points off 4th and 6 points off 5th, who have a game in hand with just 11 to play. What's left to look forward to until the end of the league season? Case. United lost the Manchester Derby, but honestly, I'm going to go straight into the first question here. Chris Tapsell asks, know you've talked about it plenty in moments, but if you were managing this squad at this point in time, how exactly would you set them up? At Letty-style mid-block encounter, ball-on-the-floor positional play, how do you approach specific games like City with an injury crisis? And I think, honestly, there isn't really much we could have expected from this game when you look at the starting 11 that was put out. You've got players like Varane, Evans, Lindelof, McTominay, Casemiro, you have no senior striker. This wasn't even United's best team or even close. We've talked about how the squad depth in this side is bad. You're playing against the best team in football. I wasn't really expecting anything from this match, whether Ten Hag was manager or not. That's not to say United set it up perfectly, but I don't really think today is the compounding example of the doom and gloom that we've been experiencing all season from a tactical point of view. I think it's just kind of an inevitable loss that happens in a season where you've had a lot of injuries.
Yeah, I agree with that. There's not a lot that you can do about. We were very injured. I think no matter what, you're going into this match looking to sit deep and play on the counter. Yeah. I'm not going to go crazy on this particular match. I don't think there were too many adjustments you could have made. Yeah. This was always going to be the outcome. Obviously, if I were in charge, I would just have United drilled to play differently to begin with. So then, yeah, I would have approached this match differently. But, like, I'm not going to say, oh, they should have gone out there and, like, tried to press really high and play with a higher line than they usually do. Because that doesn't really make sense in a one-off match against the best team in the world. So, yeah. You just got to take this one in the stomach and move on.
I mean, to frame this even more numerically, in a match you have, to frame this even more from a numbers perspective, United have 16 possible players who can play in a match, 11 starters, 5 subs. And if I look at the 16 who would have been eligible to go out today, went out today, I'm looking at like 5 or 6 who I expect to be involved in United setup in the next 5 or so years for an actual good United team. This really isn't even a portion of what I would be expecting to play over the next few seasons. It's probably not even what Ten Hag was expecting to have available this season. So, yeah, I that really puts things into perspective. And, like, obviously sometimes it's really easy to play through United. The out-of-possession drills can be better. The, you know, the way the ball is given away sometimes shows an inability to play through opposition. But I don't really think this is the match to drill down and say if United were able to do that, they would have not been battered and lost the match. You're at the Etihad. You have half a dozen injuries. And you have a bad squad depth. It is what it is.
Agreed. I don't think we have to talk much more about this.
I feel like now is really the time. I mean, it has been the time to make a decision on Ten Hag for a while now. But I think there's really nothing left in terms of results. Top 4 is borderline mathematically over. You're 11 points off with 11 games left. You have to recover 1 point per game to catch up with not many left to play. 5th place is 6 points ahead Spurs, and Spurs have played one less game than United, so in all likelihood they're going to be 9 points ahead. this season is over. United are out of the Champions League. United are out of the League Cup. They're playing Liverpool in the next round of the FA Cup in 2 weeks. So the odds of reaching the latter stages of the FA Cup are now probably below 25%, because the odds of beating Liverpool are certainly well below half, even if they play their rotated side. And even if you beat them, the odds of beating whoever's on the other side of them are also probably not that high, unless you get a team that's outside the Premier League. United scraped by Nottingham Forest earlier this week. I don't think there's anything left to play for in results this season, which means now's the time to either go, you know, and we obviously have an opinion on which one this should be, but now's the time for the club to go, yeah, either Ten Hag is out and we're going to bring someone new in next season, and you bring in any interim you want, because then, or, and you bring in any interim you want in the meantime, or it's the time to go, we're keeping Ten Hag regardless. And the reason I say that is because, well, otherwise what's going to happen is you're just going to keep wasting the rest of the season on this, like, short-termism of just get as many results as you can, when the results aren't going to matter. United aren't going to be playing Champions League football next season. They're not going to be winning trophies this season. And so the real best thing to do is try and figure out what you need to do this summer by testing out what you currently have on the pitch. You don't need to be rolling out players like Evans, who are almost certainly not going to be involved in the club's progress going forward. You don't need to be playing players like Casemiro. If you're not going to keep Amrabat, you don't need to be playing players like Amrabat. If you're not going to be keeping Antony, you're not going to be playing players like Antony, but then you should be trying other right wingers, because maybe, you know, some of the players who've been sitting on the bench all season are players you're going to look to keep next season at right wing. Now is the time to get clarity on building a long-term vision. It doesn't necessarily have to start in May when it can start now. And I personally think there is no good argument to keep him. But even if you're going to keep him, there's no good mathematical argument to be short-termist here and try and get back into this, because it's basically over. And if you want to wait another 3 games before confirming that, so be it. But the odds right now of playing Champions League football and winning a trophy this season are incredibly low. So, yeah. Case, what do you think United should be doing until the end of the season?
Yeah, I don't see any reason to keep the current manager. People who there's a lot of people I've seen who think they should keep him until the end of the year and then just sack him then. That doesn't make any sense to me. If you know you don't have faith in a manager anymore, sack him. Sack him, and then I'm less interested in the idea of finding out what you have and the players you have. Like, that matters, but for me, the incentive is you should know, like, when you enter the transfer window, prospective players should know who the manager is going to be in the ensuing season. And the only way to accomplish that is to start looking for managers before the transfer window opens, which means you have to sack the current manager before you can start that process. Like, the club realistically is not going to start that process while they're still employing.
Well, yeah, they can't be knowingly interviewing other managers while Ten Hag is coaching the team and doesn't know the future of his job yet.
Exactly.
So they can start the process, but they can only go so far before they have to pull the trigger.
So in my opinion, it's a complete no-brainer. Every moment we spend with him in charge of the club is just time wasted that we could have spent moving forward. So, yeah. If he turns this around, it will be the most surprising thing that's ever happened, in my opinion, in, like, my time viewing the game. It would take a complete tactical turnaround. Like, he would have to just completely change a variety of the tactical principles and specific implementations that he's committed to and communicate that to the players while there's this, like, mini injury crisis going on. I don't see it. Like, so, that's what I got.
Yeah, I don't really think there's a ton to add here. Basically, I mean, it's just the way management works, right? at this point, if he's coaching for his job, he's going to do what he needs to do to keep his job. Whereas I think that we're at the stage where United should be focusing on doing the thing that makes them good next season. And those aren't always going to be the same things. With that said, looking at next season, let's look at some transfers. Gene Nifton asks, with money presumably being tight in the summer, do any free agents appeal to you both? Outside of course, Mbappe, who would definitely appeal to both of us, but is going to Real Madrid by the looks of it.
The short answer to this question is no. I'll answer it like slightly differently from how it's asked. It's asked, you know, for looking for specific players that might be intriguing. And I'll say this instead. I think what we have lost sight of is, or I think I in part lost sight of this, is that if you want United to be the best side in the world, there are really very few players who can play in the best side in the world. So your threshold for talent has to just be incredibly high. And since United aren't close to that level, I'm really not that interested in populating a team with players that, like, you know, maybe have one or two interesting attributes. And I do think there are a few players who are available on a free who, like, you know, if United had a complete squad and they needed like one guy to pick up 1,000 minutes next season, I might be interested in them. But I really would prefer a summer where United make few signings, but those signings are the right signings in terms of ceiling, profile, age profile, and like just general quality, as opposed to, guys, we need 8 players and we go out and get 8 players and 5 of those guys are flawed in some way because we were trying to do it on a budget. I think you got to lean into the pain. Like, this is not going to be a short process, but if you do it right, it will be sudden when things turn around. That might be me giving a lecture, but that's just how I view it. Like, there are very few players that I'm interested in for United. Like, at any given position, there's like maybe 2 or 3. Those aren't the players whose contracts run down.
I mean, if you're picking up a player because it's going to be so cheap and on such a short-term deal that it's cheaper to get that player than to keep an existing player who isn't good enough and you need to make up the numbers, that's one thing. But let me put it this way. When you drop from being the best team in the league to the fourth best team in the league or the third best team in the league, what is on your mind is how to become the best team in the league. And that's really, really difficult. When you drop from being the third or fourth best team in the league to being the seventh best team in the league, what often comes to the mind is how to get back to being the third or fourth best team in the league, which in my opinion is not that difficult for a team like United. You just need to have broadly the right players, broadly the right tactics. United have had...
Actually, you don't need both seasons of those things. Like,
no, I mean, if you have good enough players, you just need, like, structure.
Yeah, like, yeah. Reasonable tactics.
We've seen many seasons where we thought United labored through the season, and then come April, they secure top 4 with, like, 3 or 4 games left. I think if United are managed by competent people, it will not be difficult given their budget, or what I think their budget is going to be, even if it's a little bit limited at first, to get to the point where United are the third or fourth best team in the league again. To get from fourth or third to first is incredibly difficult and requires you to have a share of the very best players in the sport, because the teams that are currently winning the Premier League have a share of those players. And the reality is, if you go and sign a full squad to get you to fourth, it becomes much more difficult to then add new players who are at that level when you've not spent the first few years acquiring that level of player. And so I think what Case is trying to get at is, even though it might not immediately get United results next season, you need to go and get the best talent you can possibly find, because that's what's going to need, that's what's going to make this team very, very good and very, very competitive in 2 to 3 seasons. Not just getting players who are good enough to play a part or a system role under a given coach.
We've fallen victim to this disease of we need, like trying to be ready to win the league in one summer or in 2 summers. Even though I think a lot of people recognize that there's a lot of changes that need to be made, you need to resign, like as a fan base, I think we need to resign ourselves to the idea that this could be slow and painful, with the caveat being when it does all click, it will click very, very fast. And you could go from very dreary to excellent very, very quickly if you do it right. And so, yeah, it's all been said already. There are a few decent players available for freeze. I don't think we should be looking to do that, because I don't think you're not going to get the U24 high impact, high ceiling guys for free.
Yeah. I mean, you might, but this summer you're not. Yeah. I mean, the only scenario in which I could see United being a title challenger in 2 seasons is if they're netting like $200 million a summer in the next 2 summers, and then you can get in 8 players worth $50 million each. Because that's what United really need right now. They need 8 players who can play regular minutes for the team. And those players seem to cost in the region of $50 million now. If you look at what teams like City are spending on their typical players, if you look at what Liverpool were spending on their title-winning team players, Salah, Mane, Van Dijk, Fabinho, when they went and bought all those players, Alisson, they were averaging spending $50 million on those guys. Like, I would not do the thing where you try to get above average talent and get 7 players for, or get 6 players for $30 million each and challenge next season. I would rather get 4-3 excellent players and then figure out a way to make the rest work in the short term. And I think you'll see that. I keep saying this, but I think we're actually on the verge of getting to doing it. We've started watching different players and teams. We're going to be talking about different targets, and we're going to be constantly banging the drum for the next 3-4 months about, is this exceptional talent? Is this potentially a player who could play for City or who could play for Real Madrid? A player who, when United come up against those teams, is good enough to actually beat those teams? Is good enough to actually consistently beat the bottom half of the table? Not just, is this an above average player who has some nice traits at Premier League level?
Yeah, basically that. And I also think that kind of feeds back into a question, like the question we got about how would we approach this side in terms of, like, if we were in charge, how would we set them up tactically? I think you just got to go through the growing pains of becoming a possession-based side. Like, just get over it. And I think that'll mean growing pains. And I think it also means having a really high bar for who the next manager is. Like, not just getting any person who seems to have, like, you know, I think the thing we've learned about this managerial stint is having modern tactical ideas doesn't necessarily mean having effective tactical ideas. I think the bar just needs to be extremely high. And yeah, you're looking to avoid false positives. I've said that probably on every episode for the past 2 months. And that's true of players. It's also true of whoever the next manager is. Aaron, you and I were talking a little bit. We'll talk in greater depth about this later, but on a future episode. But I was telling you, I was watching Julian Nagelsmann's Bayern. And, you know, there were a lot of positives that I wanted to take away from it, but I was just fixated on, I wasn't enamored with the way they were playing out from the back. And again, this is not a final verdict for me. It's just an example of, like, I really like Nagelsmann. I went into this process of looking for a new manager expecting Nagelsmann to be ultimately my final choice. But now I'm so scarred that I'm focusing, I'm really trying to like heavily index and heavily weight these negatives or how things could go poorly or how they could fail to reach their potential.
Yeah, I pretty much agree. I think relatedly, we can go to another question from Amisha, who asks, how many years away are United from a serious title challenge?
I have no idea. I would say it could be, if you do everything right, you could be title challenging, not next year, but the year after. But also, you could do everything right, and it could be a lot longer. It really... I feel like we've had this conversation before, you know, like beginning of last season, mid season last season, and there's always this inclination like, oh, things are going well, therefore the, you know, we'll be contending sooner versus, you know, as soon as whenever there's manager turnover, we push that timeline back. These things are not that predictable because you don't know how players are going to mesh with new tactics. You don't know when the right players are going to be available. You don't know when young, especially, I think the only way to build a title challenger now is to buy young and develop. You don't know when these players are going to make the jump. So, like, you know, let's say we sign Nico Williams and whoever it may be, you know, Bastoni and, you know, name some other young player, this summer. I don't know when those players are going to make the jump from like, oh, these are exciting talents to, oh, these are the best players in the Premier League. It could be next season, and then maybe you're title challenging with the right manager next season. I don't think that's likely, but maybe the takeaway from this whole podcast is like, I am inclined to stretch my error bars on everything. It's really difficult to say. I wouldn't rule out a title challenge in 2025-26. I'd say that. I think that's the earliest realistic.
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't think it's possible to do enough in the summer to catch up with the top three teams at this point, unless, like, two of them flop. I assume if Pep's at City, that's not going to happen. I'm quite confident if Arteta's at Arsenal, that's not going to happen to them either. And so I guess that leaves Liverpool. If they replace Klopp poorly, maybe there's a chance they could fall off a little bit, and then United could be the third best team in the Premier League next season. But I really think next season you want to, I'm not even going to say you want to finish fourth. I think you want to be the fourth best project in the Premier League next season. Be the fourth most promising team.
I think you can say you want to be the third. Liverpool are starting with a new manager. Like, you should, when picking a new manager at the same time as Liverpool, be able to do as well as they do and then have a process.
Yeah, I mean, I still think they have better players than us, but yeah.
Right, but like, Salah is, what, 32? That's true. Like, I don't think that's going to influence how you look at a project. Like, maybe it'll look at how good you think they are next year, but not the same thing, right?
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, look, United need 8 players. If United come away with 3 players that I'm convinced are excellent in the summer, and then they go, you know, we ran out of money, which in a way is kind of what happened last summer. They went and got Onana, Mount, and Hoyland, two of which I'm confident are going to do very well. And the third, who's with whom the main reservation I have, We had reservations about how he fit into the starting 11 when he joined, but the main reservation I have about his quality is whether he's going to stay fit at this point, and whether he's going to be able to replicate what he has already done. So you went and signed 3 players for, you know, it cost more than $50 million each, but you got 3 players who were very, very good. And I was very happy with that. And then you went and got, you know, 2 loans that you needed to fill the squad, whatever. But the important thing was, I think if United tried to spend $30 million on 5 players, the odds are very high that they wouldn't have ended up with a goalkeeper who is as good as I think Andre Onana is. They wouldn't have ended up with a striker who is as good as I think Rasmus Hojlund is. They wouldn't have ended up with a midfielder who I think is as good as Mason Mount is when he's fit. And so in a way, it's about doing that principally and repeatedly until 3 to 4 years from now when the squad is just full of excellent talent in their mid-20s who can be among the best teams in the Premier League. And then I think once you get the right coach, yeah, you can look at how Klopp, Arteta, and Pep all took a couple years to get going. But really, I don't think it takes that long for the right coaching. Like, I'm not saying it takes 2 weeks, but it definitely doesn't take 4 years for good coaching to turn the tactics around.
And I think you can also see, I now have greater conviction with this. I think you can see early on whether the tactics make sense. They don't have to be working yet, but they have to make sense. And so I think like maybe it takes a while for tactics to work, but you can see what's being attempted and it has to be coherent. And I think a lot like this is a, you know, the thing that people always talk about with Arsenal is like, oh, before they got really good, you could see that there were tactical foundations there that made sense. And I do think that's true. They were pursuing a game model that made sense and they were achieving it in certain ways, but when it broke really bad. And so I think that's kind of what you're looking for. And then I also think Arsenal just had to cover more ground in terms of improving their squad than I think we do. I think when Arteta took over, that was a club in a really bad place in terms of just having talent.
I ultimately think this United squad, like I've said, is better than the ones of the last few years. I think looking at...
I think at least the first 11 is.
Well, looking at the big teams in the league, I think where United can learn from Arsenal is, A, yes, it took time to see the signs that they were building something. They finished 8th in consecutive seasons, then they finished 5th. Is that something that you're willing to handle if in year 4 you look like a team that can consistently finish in the top 4 and do title challenges? I think that's an important thing from a tactical
perspective. They were also in 17th at Christmas, his second season.
Yeah.
Like, you have, like, because, you know, finishing 8th sounds like one thing, but you also have to remember how bad it was at a certain point and then how good it had to get for them to even finish 8th that season.
Yeah. The second thing you have to remember is that a big reason for that is because they couldn't sign a full starting 11 in a season. They couldn't go into a window.
Exactly. And plug all the gaps. That's sort of exactly.
And then the third thing, which is where I'm still doubtful about Arsenal, because I think they are overwhelmingly good tactically. I think if you're well acquainted with the side of football content, public football content that is concerned with tactical analysis, I think you will find a lot about how Arsenal have done things this season that have been tactically world-leading. Set pieces, they've been incredible. Out of possession, they've been incredible. They have the best defensive setup in the Premier League by a decent distance, even better than Man City. But I think the other aspect of this, which is where Liverpool have done better than Arsenal over the last years, in my opinion, is just signing players who create differentials that you don't otherwise get. I don't think Liverpool have been anywhere near as tactically coherent as Arsenal this season. I think they've had games where it's looked really messy. I think they've had games where they haven't really dominated opponents as expected. It took them, what, nearly 100 minutes to get the breakthrough against Forest yesterday. And while they were the better side, they didn't blow them off the park and completely hold them out the way Arsenal sometimes do to teams. But they had players who just create these huge chances and big moments in all game states against all teams. And I feel that they have more of those players than Arsenal do, and that it makes a big difference at the top level. And I mean, so this sounds obvious. Like, we're basically saying, you know, to win the Premier League, you need the best tactics and you need the best players. And I'm not saying Arsenal won't win the league this season, but I think...
I also think Saka has been playing completely out of his mind recently in a way that's different from when I think he's been on form, quote unquote, in previous seasons. And if that holds, I think that's like an example. This is something we've known. Something that Arsenal have maximized for is having players who are young enough to take another step and be that good. And so I think that gives Arsenal a better chance of winning the league this season than last season, or even than like at the beginning of this season it appeared they had.
Well, I'll say three things, right? Number one is, yes, the better Arsenal's forwards get, obviously the better chance they're going to have of winning the league. I think that pretty much goes without saying and probably applies to anybody. The second is...
Sure, but I mean more specifically, it's in like this internal improvement. Because you and I have talked about like, oh, we feel that Arsenal's great deficiency has been their recruitment of elite level final third players. But ultimately, if you have, you know, a 21, 22-year-old like Saka take a big jump...
Well, yeah, so that was number two, right? Which is, I think Arsenal are hedging their bets a lot on having a few players in their early 20s who are very good and hoping that they will become elite in the next few years, which would significantly raise their chances and probably, looking back at these few years, their trophy cabinet and their league finishes and their Champions League finishes. And then... Thirdly, I think if you look at, or I think that if Arsenal, how do I put this? I think going into this summer, Arsenal are going to target getting elite attacking players or attacking players who add components that they don't currently have. Or at least I think that's what they should be doing. And that's another example of how this takes a while. It takes a number of years to build a team. They built the possession fundamentals. They built the out-of-possession fundamentals. They're adding now the attacking talent. And in the summer, they might spend money to expedite that process and make them even closer to City over the next 3-4 seasons. And I know many people might look at it and say they're already close to City. And I think that while that might be true season to season, I think there's still enough behind them that in the current state, City would continue to win most of the Premier League titles over the next few years. Whereas I think they're going to look to close that gap even further this summer. And so like we're not mind readers. It's hard to tell what Arsenal are actually going to do next from the outside. But I think from Arsenal and Liverpool, there's a lot you can learn in different ways about how they've built teams to date and how the decisions they've made have made them able to compete for the title despite not being the best team in the league, and B, how the decisions they've made have contributed to consequences in the way they play the game and how they might be able to fix that with more time and more funds. And then the other thing I'll say about this is I think that also adds credence to the idea that you just have to sign so young. Like, even if the players you're signing are 26, if Arsenal started under Arteta in 2020 and were signing 26-year-olds, their whole team would be 30. One thing you're going to see, as in their whole team would be 30 right now. One thing you're going to see when we look at our targets is that most of the players we suggest are going to be born 2002, 2003, 2004, and maybe even a few in 2005. I don't think you're going to see us suggest anybody for big money that was born before like 1998. Yeah. And then the other thing you're going to see is that the older players are, the more I think we're going to scrutinize whether they are actually the real deal and not give the benefit of the doubt on really anything. Because if you have a player that's born in 2005 and they're already playing significant minutes at senior level, then odds are they're likely very good and they're going to have the chance to develop things that they don't already have. Whereas if you're looking at players born in 1999, they better be the full package and they better be ready to come into this team and be that player for 5 to 6 seasons before, you know, their prime years are drifting and they're heading towards the end of their contract in their 30s. So there's a lot to learn. And I think a lot of variables, another variable that we haven't talked about is how much money United actually have. I think there's been a lot of rumors in different directions and I have no idea what to think personally. So if United can only spend 100 million this summer, that's going to make the process longer. And if United can only net 100 million every summer, then that might change my expectations of what this team is going to be, but
I mean,
that's, yeah.
The thing about that, though, is, or rather, that sort of brings me to a different topic, which is this summer, I think one of the big things you have to do is sell. And I don't even mean that just to make money back. I think you really just need to be absolutely vicious about getting rid of some of these players. Even if that means the squad is really shallow next season and you have to play a lot of youth players, I think that is a lot better than having all of these like early 30-somethings hanging around, not playing well, not being part of the long-term picture. Like, you just don't see these players on other serious teams. Unless they're legacy guys.
Yeah, the gap between United's good players and United's bad players this season is massive. Like, it is huge. I think you've gotten some good minutes out of, like, Varane and Maguire at times. You've gotten some goals out of McTominay. But other than that, I can't think of many players who are not either very good or just way out of the picture, or just have been way out of the picture all season in the context of playing for a top half Premier League team. Like, none of the non-starting forwards. You've got nothing out of your substitute forwards. Zero. One of them is not playing for the club anymore. You've gotten nothing out of your, you know, backup fullbacks, whether that's because of injury or because of quality deficiency. You've gotten nothing out of most of your squad level midfielders, whether that's because Ten Hag has chosen not to play them, the system has made them look bad, or they're just not good enough. Like, or they're injured. You just, you can account for the injuries, which are difficult to foresee, if you have multiple good players and you're getting output from most of your squad. But there are, I'd say, half a dozen or more United players who have given negative impact this season. And not because they've been injured, because they have not played. Or sorry, not because they're injured, because they have played and been really, really poor. And I think, I almost think the, in some ways in the past, the lack of tactical structure has hurt players and prevented them from showing that they have the quality. But this season, I feel like a lot of the very good players, even if they haven't had great seasons, it has been pretty obvious to those who have watched the team that they are good players.
Yeah, I don't think there's much up for debate there.
So yeah, to your point, I would rather see, you know, no more 30-year-olds who aren't good enough to play for the team in 2 years. And I'd rather see, you know, 19-year-olds who end up not being good enough from the academy.
Yeah, yeah, so true. And I, honestly, I wouldn't mind if we spent big money on somebody who's young. And, like, if you get somebody else who's like Mainoo, who I think is fantastic, but I also think if you look at the results we've been getting and the performances we've been putting in, he's playing well, but he's not actually affecting team performance at a really big, at a major level. If you get another player like that in the summer, I think that's great if they're really young. Because before you wind up with massive impact on team performance, you sort of just do things tidily. Like, that's, I really think that is the main difference between a great 18-year-old and a great 21-year-old. A great 18-year-old, there are players who people are, you know, rave about who are 18 years old, but ultimately they're not really, a lot of the time they don't have great goal scoring numbers, they don't have great underlyings. If you look at Kobbie Mainoo's passing metrics, they're all horrible. Like, first percentile for progressive passes, things like that. I think any serious analytical approach to the game can see that and still recognize that he's clearly a fantastic prospect. And I think the real difference is just influence on the game. And I would rather go get players who aren't good because they haven't learned how to influence the game with their prodigious skill yet and field them, as opposed to guys who just are past the point where they can influence the game at a high level, or try to influence the game but don't have the quality to do so. Which is sort of, again, sort of that's where this talking point I have about maybe we're going to have to suffer a little bit. Like maybe you do go spend a bunch of money on a couple of 19, 20-year-olds who spend half of the season not scoring a goal after you bought them to play center forward, or go stretches of matches where it looks like they're playing well, but the team are still losing. Anyway, I digress.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think we've been talking about that with Hoyland and Garnacho all season. So,
yeah, but I think we talk about Hoyland and Garnacho and Mainoo as well, and we say, oh, these guys are so good. But why does, like, if they're so good, why is the team bad? And I think the real answer, in particular in Mainoo's case, because Garnacho's numbers are actually just crazy. I think the answer is he is fantastic for his age. There are a ton of things to like. United are still better with him in the team, but he's not exerting immense influence over matches the way the actual best midfielders in the league do. And I don't even think it's necessarily a huge skill gap. I think it's a volume and confidence thing.
Awesome. Yeah. I think that does it in terms of framing where we are with the state of this team and talking a little bit about a rebuild. Do you want to maybe go to no details?
Yeah, I think that seems appropriate on a week.
Okay,
like this.
So I think from next week onwards, we're going to take a look at a little bit more in terms of some players and managers that we think United should be looking at, just to give you guys something to look forward to as the season winds up and we look into the summer transfer window. And also as rumors begin to ramp up, because I think as United on the pitch become less interesting, everybody's going to increasingly be talking about what United are going to do next to become interesting again. And so with that, we'll go to No Details, which is the segment where we allow you to ask us anything, but with one caveat. The questions cannot be about football. Now, the first one is half about football here, but I think it counts as not about football in the grand scheme of what we talk about on this podcast. Conrad, who is actually my cousin, asks, what are each of your methods for getting over disappointing football results? Case, I'll let you go first.
Sure. I do pub trivia with my friends on Sundays.
Nice. Pub trivia is awesome.
That usually gets me out of a funk. And, well, I've pretty reliably needed it to get me out of a funk this season.
Pub trivia is the only scenario in which I have a great time losing.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm like the sorest loser. But pub trivia, it's like we get eighth and, like, crash a few pints. And
I still
had
a good
night.
Time. Yeah. Yeah.
Get over football results. Gosh. I think, idealistically, I want to say I would play music or take a walk outside. But the truth is, the weather's been kind of weird the last few weeks in Canada. And I haven't actually been playing music recently. Like, I used to play the piano a lot, but I haven't really been playing of late. So I think my recent answer has been watching different movies. Or listening to new music. I've been trying to make an effort.
Have you seen Dune?
I have not seen either Dune 1 or 2. Do you like it?
Ooh, okay. Dune 1, maybe kind of, not really spoilers. I won't spoil anything. Dune 1, loved it. First of all, I read the book, like, when I was a kid. So I probably have like a slightly different angle on it than a lot of people watching it. I watched Dune 2. It is a beautiful movie. The score is fantastic. The cinematography is fantastic. I personally found the script and the acting very lacking, and I feel they didn't do justice to a lot of the storylines, and a lot of it was rushed. But everyone else I know loves it. So definitely watch Dune 1 at least. And watch Dune 2. It's worth seeing because it is beautiful. Like, Denis Villeneuve is a director. All of his movies are gorgeously shot. Like, every frame is a piece of art. But everybody was hyping this up to me so much, and I was like, oh, is this really going to be as good as I want it to be? And I would say, in terms of the narrative, it was not. Those are my thoughts.
That definitely sounds like something I should watch. I feel like I have to do a Villeneuve a Villeneuve binge, because he has a bunch of movies that I've always been interested in seeing, but just never actually watched them. Recently, yeah. I said this a few weeks ago. I've been trying to get through the Oscar Best Picture noms before the Oscars. I think I'm actually going to lose that race, but all of the ones I've watched have been at worst entertaining and, like, at best, I think very good. I mean, we've talked about Barbie and Oppenheimer on here. The Holdovers is a really nice, fun movie. I mean, it's quite dark, but it's uplifting in a way. So I feel like it's a really enjoyable watch. I've seen mixed reviews of it on Twitter, but I personally really liked Past Lives. I don't know if you've seen it yet.
I haven't seen it yet, no. And I haven't seen The Holdovers either. Have you seen American Fiction?
I haven't
yet.
My brother watched it last week, and he was telling me it was very good.
So good. So good. Like, fantastic. I would highly recommend.
Yeah, I think I'm going to... The problem is, I've gotten through all of the ones except for Maestro that are on, like, streaming platforms, but I haven't actually...
Maestro is also fantastic.
Really? I've heard a lot of mixed reviews on it, so I'm...
I think it's really good. I think it's really good, personally. But
And then the other one I've seen is Killers of the Flower Moon, which is a marathon, but very poignant. Like, I was thinking about it for days after watching it, which is, I think, what the intent of the film is. Just to make you sit and think about what they did and what we do that
is equivalent. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean
to. No, yeah. you said it better than I probably would have.
I haven't seen it, but I do have a friend who said he didn't enjoy it, but it's objectively fantastic film.
I think that's about right. Like, we had to do an intermission because it is really long. Like, we paused the movie and it's like it was an hour and 50 minutes deep and there was an hour and a half left. We have one more no details question here from G. Nifton, who asks, what subject do you wish you had studied at uni or school instead of the one you actually chose? Case, I'll let you go first again.
Okay, sure. I actually initially was studying political science and computer science when I started my degree. I find politics very, very interesting, but ultimately switched to just pure data science. The other thing that I later on realized I really cared about was linguistics and languages. So linguistics maybe, or just straight up studying a language. I really wish I'd at least like double majored or minored in some language, just because I think languages are awesome. Those are my answers.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, I feel like if I took a guess, I probably would have said that's what you would have said. For those who don't know Case as well as I do, he is an avid Spanish speaker and
that's a crazy
avid
phrase.
Dutch speaker and an avid English speaker. Like, I think avid is the wrong word.
Avid is definitely not the right word.
Avid is the wrong word. Case is trilingual, in my opinion, at least. I don't know if he would consider himself trilingual. So that makes it. And, like, I think largely you've learned Spanish by just reading and consuming Spanish media. Trying to talk to people you know who speak Spanish in Spanish.
Yeah, that,
which
yeah.
is very much a labor of love, I feel like. It's not like a like taking classes and being forced to learn it.
Yeah, it's definitely a passion thing. Yeah, that's not where I started. I did take lessons as a child, and also I have family in Barcelona who a lot of them don't speak anything but Spanish and Catalan, and so Spanish I already had a sort of foundations in, and for a while I dated an Argentine girl. You're getting all of the lore. These are all the things that ultimately drove me to learn more and more Spanish, and then, yeah, now I read. Anyway, what's your answer?
Yeah, so I am scheduled to finish two undergraduate degrees in August. I'm doing my Bachelor of Math and Statistics and my Bachelor of Business Administration and Finance. I guess I'll take them one at a time because I'd make substitutions on both sides. On the math side, I went into statistics because I had this idea that I was going to become a data scientist and that it was really practical. And I think I had some misconceptions about, you know, the things you hear about the practicality of math in general. A lot of people will tell you that it's not applicable to the real world in certain fields, which I don't actually agree with anymore. And I think if I had had that same vision a few years ago, I might have switched into something like optimization, mathematical optimization or operations research, and like math problems as they pertain to like allocation of a fixed amount of resources to maximize a certain output. And like,
that was a very specific,
it sounds very specific, but my university, Waterloo, they have the biggest math faculty, I think, in North America, and they actually have a full program for this with like dozens of courses available. So you can actually get very deep into this. And a lot of people who actually end up in finance have masters and PhDs in this particular area of math, because a lot of financial problems are like describably
optimization problems.
As for business, I actually think I don't think my entire career is going to be spent in finance or even really related, because I haven't really found a role within banking or finance that like I particularly think is right for me for a number of reasons. But I am actually very passionate about financial education and like people as a whole, especially younger people in Canada and the States, having a better education than they do about how the financial system actually works. Because I think if people knew how it worked, they would A, make better life decisions, and B, also have a better understanding of why things in the world are the way they are. And I think this is just paramount. And I can't speak for the States, I guess, but in Ontario, it is not covered at all in the education system unless you opt into it. The rest of my degree, though, I felt to get a business degree, I had to take a lot of business courses that I wasn't really interested in. So I would have loved to swap those for like something like sociology or psychology, where I would have to do a lot more reading from like anyone who's done like undergraduate math or engineering. I at least in my experience, haven't done a ton of like reading other people's research and then interpreting it. It's been a lot of like learning accepted theories and applying it, which is also valuable, but I think it would make me more well-rounded to have to critically study someone else's opinion on something that is not entirely scientific and have an interpretation on that. I think that's a really valuable skill that I also didn't value enough when I was 18.
Yeah, a lot of that stuff is very difficult to value when you're choosing a degree. And I agree. Yeah, understanding, I think by design, I think it's particularly true in the U.S., people are, the education system is not meant to educate people on how our financial,
regardless of political view, I think you should understand the financial system especially as it pertains to you and how you accumulate and spend money. And I think 90% of people do not, and that is a major problem
through no fault.
Yeah,
of their
I'm
own.
Not. Yeah, I'm the last person I would have blame is like.
Yeah, I know you. I know
the old like teaching phrase.
Only clarifying for the
only
audience.
Teaching phrase.
Yeah,
or I'll quote the famous teaching phrase of like, if one person fails the exam, it's their fault. If everybody fails the exam, it is usually the teacher's fault.
It's the teacher's
and
fault.
And very similarly, yeah. Manchester United are failing, and it is likely the manager's fault. And with that, we're looking forward to producing some different kinds of content for you guys until the end of the season. Hopefully it makes things exciting again. Like, I know you could probably tell it took into about 20 minutes of this episode for us to get some excitement about what we were talking about, because we're really searching for reasons to be excited. But hopefully we can turn this into an opportunity for you guys to listen to something that is enjoyable and makes you still enjoy the aspects of football that are enjoyable, because there are many once you get out of the realm of the current Manchester United.
Agreed.
All right. With that, thanks for listening, everyone. We'll see you next week. Hope you enjoyed this week's Devils in the Details. You can follow us at Devils ITD Pod on Twitter, or on a variety of streaming platforms. Our awesome theme music was made by Jacob Connor. You can find at Jacob J. Connor on Twitter. Have a great week, and we'll see you next time.